The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this April 29, 2013, 158th edition of The Heretics Hour. I'm winging it tonight with no notes, except for the very briefest that I have managed to put together. And this is really a first for me. I didn't have much on Saturday. I may be getting used to getting on the air with not much preparation, although I have a lot of material. Mostly it is on web pages that I have open. I have a bunch of web pages open, but I don't have the usual kind of notes. So we'll see how it goes. As I've said, I've been, it's been getting more and more difficult to accomplish all the things that I'm trying to do. And today I completed a new article for Elie Wiesel Cons the World, which I started yesterday, and I was just determined to get it posted because I haven't posted anything there for a while. So I did. It's up there, although I haven't mailed it out. But it's the title is The Enemy in Our Midst, Elie Wiesel's USHMM Celebrates 20 Years. And, of course, USHMM is the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. You may have read a little bit about it in the news today, although there wasn't much. I kept looking for news stories yesterday and couldn't find anything, but I did find other interesting things. And finally this morning, there was one. But it was what was going to happen today, but it was kind of updated. And then now there are some stories finally about what took place. They had their big, tribute ceremony in the museum with Bill Clinton speaking and Elie Wiesel speaking. And I'm going to talk about that. I have quite a bit to say about it. It was quite underwhelming, I will have to say. I don't think it was hard to find any news. It just is not grabbing people, and even the news people find that it's not being read, I guess, so they drop it, from their lineup, or they put it way down at the bottom. It's there for a little while, and then it's gone. So that's because it's not getting, I would assume, they don't have any hits on it. They're not showing that it's popular, and they always want their most popular stories to be running. So this is good news. But there's a lot that isn't good news, at least as far as I'm concerned, since I would like that museum affects me negatively as badly as Elie Wiesel himself does. And to me, they're just one and the same thing, pretty much. So we'll talk about that after a while. And, of course, I welcome callers in the second hour, 1-830-443-4911. And so I'm going to start with the Boston bombing business again in the beginning to make some comments and read some comments that I've looked at. And, it's hard to know what to call it. Now, I just want to say that I talked about it on Saturday's program. And I was really enjoying talking about it because I had just refreshed my mind myself about some of the facts about it. And I felt pretty clear about it, but then I had second thoughts afterwards and I was thinking, how much of this can they do? How much can they do with not real people, experiencing real things? And either they are actors or they are computer generated images. And as I looked over at this Clues forum again, they were emphasizing that it was almost all computer generated. And then Martin wrote in on the White Network about the program, and he was saying something like that. And I'm going to refer to that in a minute. And what I wrote, and I'll try to be brief with it, not bore you with it. And then some stuff over there on the Clues forum, but looking at that before the program, what I was thinking about after I had my second thoughts, but then later I thought, Carolyn, that's like That's like the people who can't bring themselves to believe that the Holocaust did not happen as they say it did. They've seen things that convince them, and they have not studied it deeply or not capable of it. Maybe it's not that difficult with the Holocaust, but they just can't bring themselves to believe it. And I don't want to be like those people. These, you know, once I figured out the Holocaust, and it really wasn't difficult. All it took for that was to drop that sense that you can't question that. You know, that can't possibly, you know, be true that nothing like that happened, that they didn't have any gas chambers. After all they've talked about gas chambers all this time, how could it be that they weren't really there? But, you know, now I know that it's so plain as day, and I wonder why people can't see it. It's only because they don't want to see it. And so then I say, well, I don't want to be that way about these new things, because I don't really understand, computer image manipulation, all those things that they can do. I know I don't, so I know my own limitations, but I can look and see what makes sense to me. It makes sense that there's something very wrong with these events, every one of them. There's always huge questions that are not answered. And, well, we can start with 9/11. 9/11 is so obvious to me, and it should be obvious to everyone, because if they say that these planes brought down these two buildings, and that's what they say, that they started whatever happened there, and they will not admit that there are any explosives of any kind. Well, then you have Building 7. No planes hit that. Why did that go down? I mean, slam dunk, you know? I mean, you got to answer this. You can't answer it. Well, I was saying, is this man who had this Jeff Bauman, who had his legs blown off, is he like that? Or, you know, is he something so obvious as that? It seemed to me that he was. There's no explanation given for this person, you know, these pictures that we see, and why they are what they are. They don't make sense either, but they're not as impressive or as clear cut as the gas chamber thing, because we know, you know, that's been proven by revisionists that this impossible, this whole gas chamber story and the numbers that they're talking about and so on are just it's just impossible. And there's evidence, material evidence and everything, but they don't allow it in a court, and the media won't talk about it. So the same with 9/11. The evidence is there, but they don't allow it. They won't talk about it. And they've got people, mesmerized about attacks by evil doers, you know, the Nazis in World War II, and now the Muslims. And, of course, they play on that. You know, if you're not in love with Muslims, I used to be a lot more pro-Muslim than I am now, because I want to, I'm a promoter of a white society. I think that's the only answer for us. And that means mostly Muslims, are not white, and for the most part, you know, we're talking about the native Muslims. So, Middle Eastern and so on. So, I don't want to put those people off the hook, although I certainly believe they didn't have anything to do with 9/11. And now maybe they didn't have anything to do with this Boston bombing. And that would be the obvious place to go from what I know. But yet I'm still hesitant to do so. So it takes time. But it just seems as though there's not enough explanation. Let me go to this comments here. I wrote to, Martin wrote in to say that, you know, thought it was a good show, simply because I talked about that. And he said some things, but then I was having my second thoughts, and I said, where's mine? Yeah, I said that I had a hard time explaining. After I had read afterwards, I had checked it out, and that they do say in the media that 14 people have had lost at least one limb during this at this bomb blast, and I've seen three of them on television. Not on television, I don't watch that, but on the internet, you know, and from video clips or photographs or something. Three of them in their hospital bed. Well, two of them, I think I just saw a photograph, and which was taken from a video, and the other one was the video of this woman chatting with reporters, and she didn't look happy, but she was willing to come out and talk about it. She only lost a foot. She didn't lose like both of her legs like this bomb guy. But when you think about all those people, in 14 people in hospitals and so on, and all these hospital personnel talking about it, and all, you know, and people, friends and family, and people who know them and who can say things, it just doesn't make sense to think that that's all fake. I don't think they can do all that. So then Martin answered and said that first he was saying that there weren't, they're downplaying actors. And I noticed just after, you know, in the last pages at Clues Forum, they were talking about, well, we don't want to talk about actors anymore because it's all computer generated imagery. There's not much in the way of actors. So that's, they said the media wants to push the idea that wants, you know, dissidents to push the idea of actors because that will get us into all kinds of trouble and they'll be able to prove that they're not actors and I don't know, one thing or another. So they were going along that line, which was new to me, but as I say, I'm not a big follower of that. But now Martin is saying also that he's not denying the use of actors, but there's a blend of techniques. You'd have some of this and some of that. Well, again, you know, I like Martin, and he just feels sincere to me, and, you know, somebody you can kind of trust. But at the same time, he's very sold on all this stuff, and he's not really working on Boston. He wasn't really working on Sandy Hook. He's working on other things that go on in the United Kingdom, mostly. So he's the only one that will write here and write to me, because this is another thing coming up. These that I thought about this afternoon, these people at Clues Forum are not interested in the Holocaust. And all these 9/11 truthers are not interested in the Holocaust. Some of them are kind of coming along a little ways, but they can't come very far. And that is, I think it's their politics. I think that the people that run Clues Forum are probably more on the liberal side, more on the left, open side, you know, open society and all this, than on the, well, I'm going to use the word fascist. I never use the word fascist, but it's become used lately. So then on the fascist side, or the idea of having a strong central government for nations and having strong laws and having racial separation and ethnic separation in nations and things like that. And these people are not interested in that. In fact, I'm sure they think it's terrible. I'm sure they think what the white network presents, the whole position we have, is terrible. They wouldn't agree with it. So they're not interested in working with us, I guess. But Martin understands, it seems like it, but it's, you know, they're not going to, they probably all believe in the Holocaust. Like I said last week, that one guy, Martin says he doesn't think he's Jewish, and he's not doing that because he's Jewish, but he obviously is a believer in Holocaust. He stood up for it earlier, and then he stood up for Steven Spielberg. So this is a big, big difference. So I say, well, if these people are so into clues and finding, you know, how the establishment is trying to control every last thing that we think and see, and using these big police forces, you know, trying to one thing they say is they're trying to turn the police into these big heroes. And of course, these police today, they're like riot police and disaster fighting police. They're all dressed up in these big, huge black uniforms with huge boots and helmets and face
guards and huge guns, and they look like, you know, I mean, they look horrible. They don't look like any friendly policemen. So it's all different. I do believe that they're always trying to put us astray, put questioners, put intelligent people looking at this and being critical of it, put them on the wrong track and all. We got real used to that with 9/11, and that's still going on. So you have to take that into consideration, which leaves me really with just wondering what the heck can be believed or said, or what kind of good work anybody's doing. I think I was going to read this from the. I need to get back up. From something that was on the last page of the Clues Forum. Here, there's some good things. People asking questions like I have. Let me see here, which is it? All right, this guy named Daspot wrote, you know, he's a newcomer. He's made his introduction. And he says, he appreciates the explanation that they're given, that he was given, and he can readily see examples of computer-generated imagery and photoshopping in the photo stills that have been published, but he doesn't see them in the live footage, you know, the live filming that they show. He doesn't see any clear signs of it there, and he would appreciate some help in pointing out how he, you know, where the signs of the digital fakery is and so on. He's trying to come to terms with the idea of near total CGI position. You know, that everything is computer generated imagery. You know, these are the people who are the no planes people, that this whole, everything we saw on TV of the planes going into the buildings on 9/11 and so on was all just created in the, you know, in the studio, never really happened, and so on. I've never been able to get my head around that. But I realize I don't know enough about it. I'm not an expert on it, but I do think you shouldn't have to be an expert on that to have some feeling for it. So, but anyway, he gave an example here which didn't show me anything. So I still have the same questions. And here's somebody now. I'm sorry. This is what happens when I'm not really well prepared. I'm going to go to these pages. There was something very good, I thought. I guess I was on it. Okay, yeah, well, I was on it in the beginning, and then I moved up. All right, then this fellow named Frost. This is the very last post on this whole thread on page 47, which says exactly what I would like, you know, expresses exactly my own feelings. He has, I don't know who he's writing to, just anybody and everybody. He says, okay, Clues Forum. And he's kind of new. He said, he's got 33 posts. He's not that new. Okay, he says, you keep focusing on spotting a fakery in photos and videos. Have you realized yet that they are made on purpose? That's what I would think they're doing. That's what I'm saying, to put you, set you off. They make all these mistakes to make you go off here, there, and everywhere. They do it on purpose. Why they did it, he asked, because they can. You go and tell people around that you have proof of fakery, and they will ask you straight away, not even analyzing it, what about victims and survivors? Well, that's exactly what I'm asking about. You're going to tell them that they never existed. They're computer-generated images. This is the address of Costco warehouse where Bauman used to work. And he gives an address at 311 Daniel Webster Highway, Nashua, New Hampshire, and a phone number. Of this, it's just the Costco warehouse, and he says that Bauman used to work there. I don't know, that's what he's saying. He says, go and visit this place. Maybe that's on his face. You know, they've got all kinds of stuff on there now about this Bauman. Facebook pages, you know, and they're raising, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, getting close to $1 million now for his medical bills and so on. These people, that's one thing they go into a lot on this clues form. And it's true. I mean, every one of these people, you think, well, they need the money. But it's amazing how much money is raised. And they show you on their pages and so on, how much they have and how much their, what their goal is. So it says, if you'd go to this, Costco warehouse where he used to work, what do you expect to hear if you asked about him? One, no, he wasn't working here. We are surprised that the media claims that he was. Two, yes, he was working here, but he never did have any legs. Three, yes, he was working here. He had legs. in case of answer number three, which is what you think you might get, well, what do you say about that? Were they all paid to lie? The warehouse, the neighborhood, the whole community of Nashua. My theory, this guy says, is that he's a real person from one of these families which cooperate with perps. I have a little bit of a hard time with that. I don't know why, though. After the event, he will go for rehabilitation with family, and nobody will hear about them anymore. Well, that's what I suspect, too, is that after they finish showing themselves as amputees and in the hospital and all of that, they'll just fade away, and you'll never hear about them again. They'll fade away with all that money they made. He says, but now he has to play for a while in telly, and no member of the public will see him live. We'll only see him on television, they say. If he will come back to Nashua, well, I'll give up. You know, if he comes back and they see him, well, then, you know, it's a different story. But he says, I refuse to believe that his legs were sacrificed for some big cause. Nobody would do that. In this case, we are helpless and never will find out what really happened. So, this guy doesn't write too well. So-called rational thinking does not work. If you try to think rationally about it, you just can't figure it out. Because he says, to me, a really rational thinking should take in consideration that we don't know about all the possibilities, because they simply never revealed them. 9/11 is an example. That is, we can't figure it out because there's nobody being made to say anything. And that's been known for a long time. We're left with all this speculation with never any positive proof, because except for what didn't happen, because and that they're showing fake images, or I don't know if they're fake images. They're either fake images or they're, of course, they're not, because people live in New York and see those empty spaces and those buildings are gone. So it can't be fake. I mean, it did happen. So it's a case of it's something else is causing it than what they say. So I thought, you know, this is where my questions are on this. And I don't find that what I'm suspicious of now is that here at Clues Forum, they have lots and lots of pages and lots of people spend lots of time, searching around for clues and looking, reading all this stuff and doing a lot of work on it. But they never come up with, they can't answer even simple questions without just kind of going around in circles. And I can believe that it's because they can't be answered I can believe that, but anyway, that's the case. They can't. And then there's that thing that they're not interested in debunking the Holocaust, because it's their political belief. So I think they don't like the New World Order because they think it's going to be real totalitarian. But they'll try to, I don't know, expose that. But they don't like the kind of world orders that had become popular in the 30s and 40s, and so they don't like that either. So they're not going to try to expose that or get to the truth of that. So that's where I am with that. I really shouldn't talk about it too much because Well, I don't know. I think I can bring a, you know, just an ordinary intelligent person's perspective to it and say how I feel about it. I know it's funny business, but just exactly how, I don't think we're getting much help. And this is the problem in this. We have people at different, in different places about it, and they're kind of get antagonistic toward one another. Well, I get antagonistic too, so I can't criticize people for that. But it doesn't, we don't get anywhere. And so speaking of not getting anywhere, let me get a drink of water here. Speaking of not getting anywhere, we're not getting very far in our Holocaust revisionism. It's all there. It's all been done. But the problem is, it doesn't reach the people, and the people who are preventing it remain in power, and nothing changes. So nothing that you do gets any notice. Now, I think I'll just get rid of this page. I can see my other pages and get rid of this page. And, and go to here. All right. So, So the celebration today, the 20th anniversary. I don't quite know how I want to start this for the best impact. But I will say that what I can see going on is several things a new approach by the Holocaust Museum is to link World War II veterans or, you know, American soldiers with the survivors as being the ones who liberated them, in a sense of saying, you know, putting out the message, American soldiers went to war in Europe to save the Jews. That's what it comes down to. You know, oh, here we have these they brought the World War II veterans and the Holocaust survivors together today. And yesterday, I guess, and mostly today at their museum. I bet that went over real well. They probably weren't even interested in one another. But anyway, it's all a big public relations thing. There's nothing real in any of this. There's nothing behind it. It's just all done for public relations. And so this message, you know, is that they have to keep making themselves this museum group, keep having to make themselves seem to be like they belong here in the United States. And so now they've come up with this great idea of putting together World War II vets with Holocaust survivors so that they will feel more Americanized. And this is they talked about that. Elie Wiesel and Bill Clinton gave speeches today, and Bill Clinton talked about that. And it's the same thing as the Civil War. You know what they've done with the Civil War, saying that it was fought to free the slaves. It's the same thing they want to do with the Holocaust, is saying that the World War II was basically fought to save the Jews in Europe from being genocided, and this is the overall theme that they're working toward. And the longer it gets out, you know, the further away, further back in time it becomes, the more they can put on a meaning that is not real, that people at the time would know was not. People used to know, and a lot of people still know, that has, you know, was not the reason at all for World War II. But people at Civil War time knew that it wasn't about the slaves. But today, people kind of accept that, even if they sort of know better. But all these in school, they teach it that way. I know they do. I've seen it you know, and even 10 years ago, they were already doing that with these really not at all, not smart at all, grade school teachers and junior high school teachers and so on, who teach just what they're told to teach. Because they're teaching history. They don't really know anything about history, but they have lesson plans and they're told, you know, what to teach and what to say. And that's in there now. And the books that they have on their list for the kids to read are books that say things like that too. So it's all a way to corrupt our true history, to make it, either what you want to call the New World Order, the Jew World Order, or just international Jewry wants, and Israel wants to be the reigning beliefs that the people have. And this is why it gets me so angry, because I just hate these lies. You know, I just see these lies, and it's so, I just get furious, and I want to expose these lies, and you know, we do it. All kinds of people do it, but far more people just continue to believe them. So I've got this article up there, and it's mostly about coming from the perspective that this Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. is our enemy. And I said that on Saturday. I said, this is the enemy right here. These people, they represent the enemy. And that this museum actually shouldn't exist in the United States. And it actually should be abolished. It should be closed down. It should be shut down. And I give some of the history of it. And I talk about, I have one heading here. It was organized and brought into being under false pretenses and for illegitimate reasons, because, you know, they go after these politicians. And these politicians, when they're vulnerable, and they want to be reelected. That's what it's all about. Jimmy Carter, you know, was only a one-term president, and he was very popular when he got in, but then his administration had problems. And so he was kind of on shaky ground for a large part of it, but he still wanted to be reelected for a second term. And he was in he was out in January 81, so he lost in November 1980. And it was in September 1979, 1 year before that. Or am I a year off? I could have this a year off, but that Wiesel had been working on him and his group, and he had and they had given him this report that, because he had allowed them, he had named them to a commission called the President's Commission on the Holocaust to explore the idea of some memorial in the United States for this, and they put it in the form of that they wanted to fight genocide. It was going to be mainly, you know, it wasn't going to be just about Jews and the Holocaust, but it was going to be something to prevent genocide in the future, all very, you know, democracy and so on. But in September 79, they gave it to him. Well, he needed their help, you know. I mean, he needed the Jews' help. And then they also had to vote for it in Congress. And the Congress was up for re-election too. You know, the entire House of Representatives, every member, and then a third of the Senate was up for re-election at that time. So you get a lot of people. Well, of course, it passed unanimously. I think there might have been one person that didn't vote, but nobody voted against it. So that's how they get in. That's how they get these things started. And it never seems like it's going to be as... you know, it always seems like, well, what's the big deal? You know, what's the big deal? Oh, let them do this. It makes them happy. This is the way we always give things to Jews, our people. Always give things to Jews, because they're after you, And you think, well, you know, just give them what they want here. Because you don't see them as powerful as they are. And they are much more powerful now than than they were then. And they keep getting more powerful. So they also gave them 2 acres of land for to build their building. And I don't imagine they pay real estate taxes on that. And they the Jews came up with all the money for the building. But what that land that they're on would have been much more valuable than the building they have, which was about, I don't know, they raised $1 million or something. It's easy for Jews to raise money. And so they are able to design and build the building exactly as they wanted to. It's very Jewish looking, take care of it inside exactly as they wanted to. And they have this, this budget of, around $50 million a year. I have their financial report that they have to present to Congress, every year from 2011. That's the latest one. And, it says that what they received from the federal government in 2011 was $48,400,000. So, $48.4 million. And they raised on their own, non-appropriated, that is, you know, from donations and so on, $36.5 million for a total of $84.9 million. To run their affairs. Well, you know, they waste a lot of money. They are lavish in what they do. They go all out for things. So they could, you know, they could support themselves. If they can raise $36.5 million a year and, they don't need this government money and they could be on their own. That would be an improvement. I'm going to tell you why. Because it, you know, as today's money, that's not all that much money, but, they also have long-term investments of $205 million over, a little over $205 million. So that's money that, you know, that they don't, it's like a person's capital, you know, that's their capital, but they're worth over $200 million. Plus they get this, they take in under $100 million every year to operate on. So, you know, they're sitting pretty, and that's the way Jews are. They always want to have plenty of money to spare for whatever might happen, you know, to protect themselves. So even though this is not like a big part of the U.S. budget, they are a national government aid. They're some kind of a government entity, and they're supported by the government. They've, you know, been kind of like approved by the government, and they therefore are able to use that by saying, you know, like this thing they had, they've had this year for the 20th anniversary. They call it a national tribute, and I mentioned this Saturday, you know. You know, they're giving it, I don't know what you call it, but they're offering a tribute, to the Holocaust survivors from the nation, from this nation. They make themselves representatives of this nation in wherever it comes to, what they call Holocaust. You know, they make the Holocaust so important, and all these people go along with it. So they are the ones who are the national U.S. representatives for how we look at the Holocaust, what we think about it, what we do about it. And they're trying to grow. Let me just take this in turn here. This, they still talk about the 6 million too. A few days ago or something, you know, during this period of time, not just today, but this museum director is currently Sarah Bloomfield, and she is a real go-getter, I'll tell you. She works hard to promote this museum. And she said that she emphasized that even though they want to talk about in this exhibit that they have for this 20-year anniversary, they want to talk about all the people, not just the Nazis and the Germans, but all of the people who didn't do anything to help the Jews. You know, they want to emphasize, because it's called collaboration and complicity in the Holocaust. Actually, their theme for this 20th anniversary thing is never forget, and you can do something. You know, it's up to you to do something, trying to make it real that people need to be worrying, you know, doing something about genocide, wherever they find it. And then she says, but she wanted to, and then this exhibit is about, this title, Some Were Neighbors, Collaboration and Complicity in the Holocaust, and, you know, featuring, all the people who are guilty, not just the Nazis. But she says she still wanted to emphasize that the museum's main goal is to honor the memory of the 6 million murdered Jews. She says they're making a commitment to these people who are there, including the vets, that they will, that they will carry forward this legacy. So what they're doing here, and I haven't explained it very well, I perhaps will as I'm going along here, do better. It's a giant guilt trip on white Euro-Americans. That's what it is. Because they're moving toward that. They're moving away from saying, well, this is the Nazis and the Jews back then, because that's getting so far in the past and people are not going to be interested in. People are going to say, well, that's over and, you know, well, we're not Nazis anymore. But they can't accept that. They can't accept that because this is an ongoing reality for them that has to get stronger and stronger. They're this big, huge religion of Holocaust. So now they are, as everybody knows, I know everybody listening to me knows how they have spread it out to all white people and all European people and all kinds of people who didn't do enough. And now they're coming right out with it in their propaganda. And this special anniversary, Some Were Neighbors, Collaboration and Complicity in the Holocaust, as I say, is an allusion to all those guilty ones who stood by and did nothing to prevent the terrible treatment of the Jews. What they never consider, however, is how many thought the Jews deserved it. Of course, the narrative of the horrendous suffering of Jews has been wildly exaggerated beyond all semblance to the reality. This, however, is not allowed to be said. So, but the question never, never, ever arises to why people stood by and didn't try to help the Jews. If they were their neighbors or whatever, maybe they can't consider that they were glad to see these Jews go. All kinds of people, all in all these Eastern European countries too, were glad to see the Jews go. And that's presented as just horrible, horrible of these people. You know, you never can say that, well, maybe that, you know, it was because the Jews weren't liked and maybe there's good reason for that. The Jews should take a look at that. That never comes up. But this, curator of this Some Were Neighbors exhibit, Susan Bachrock, says she is challenging the idea that in her exhibit that the Holocaust was primarily about Hitler and other Nazi leaders. A quote from her is, the Holocaust wouldn't have been possible without enormous indifference. You know, that's one of Wiesel's favorite words. He's always talking about the worst thing is indifference. Well, they're using that. Enormous indifference throughout Germany and occupied Europe, but also thousands of people who were just doing their jobs. So here we have all the people who didn't stop it, you know, and all the nations who didn't stop it, are becoming guilty, are being thrown into this whole mix. Now, this, I think, is their whole game plan. This woman is not thinking this up on herself, this Susan Bachrock. She's, you know, that she knows that that's the way they want to take this. And I wonder how it's working, because it seems to me it's going to backfire, that you can't go. It's again a situation where the Jews go too far. They just push and push. They don't seem to know, because they're never satisfied. They don't have enough. They want more. They want more. They want to get stronger. they want to lord it over you even more. So I told you about the financial situation, and but the more important is how that they are part of the government. They're part of the government. But so I do suggest, not that I have any power there, but I do have a position now on this anyway, and that is that this museum can be turned over to the Jews. It doesn't have to be part of the government, and it shouldn't be a part of the government. There's no background for it. There's no reasoning for it. I'm trying to see where I kind of wrote about that. What I said, but it was forced on us. It was forced on the people of this nation who never voted for it, never accepted it, never said, oh yeah, it's okay, you can use the tax money and build this museum there and be supported by our tax money. None of that was ever done. So it was one of these things, you know, that they sneakily got through. And then once they get there, they've got all these statements by their mission statements and so on that were approved that they can point to. And that's, they're solidly in there and you can't get them out. But I think it should be gotten out. And the first step would be to put them in charge of their own museum 100%, which they can very well do. A final note I have on this article, Elie Wiesel, Concert World, is that for their 20th anniversary, they have launched a campaign to raise $540 million by 2018. You know, 2018 is the 25th, would be the 25th anniversary. I wondered why they're having a 20th anniversary, but they're going to have a 25th too, because, and then they're going to have a 30th and a 40th and a 50th, I suppose. Every 10 years they'll have one. But they did this, they said, because they didn't want to wait for the 25th, because all these people, all these elderly World War II vets and Holocaust survivors, a lot of them might not still be alive 5 years from now. So they went ahead and did this on the 20th, and they've set up this goal now to raise $540 million by 2018. And they've already secured gifts totaling $258.7 million of it. And they want to use it to just increase the size of what they are, you know, and increase their programs, increase everything that they do, do it bigger, better. And they're going to even double the size of the museum's collections and conservation center, it says. So I've got some stuff I'll say in the next hour about all their bragging about all that they are accomplishing. but this shows that they can very well support all this themselves. They do, you know, it's all Jews at that museum. All Jews. It's just amazing if you look at, well, we've got that here. I've got all that in this story. But right now, I'm going to save that for the second hour, I guess. I want to talk about, what is this? I have to make sure I'm still on the air. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, listeners, for being here. Let me go back to my little notes here where I did take some notes on the speeches by Elie Wiesel and Bill Clinton today. It was this afternoon. I clicked and I found that NBC had a video of the two of them speaking. That hardly, you know, as I say, there was very little coverage of this, very little. And this part is probably not even there anymore. But it wasn't the whole speeches, thank goodness, because I could hardly listen to them as much as they had there. I could really hardly stand to listen to them. Even Bill Clinton was just disgusting. So, but they kind of cut and pasted in, I guess, what they thought was the most meaningful parts. And so it started out with Wiesel. He was the first to speak. And here's some of the things he said, you know, as he always says, you young people must carry our memories because you will be here when we are gone. They are. He's always talking about memory, and he tells people that to know a witness is to be a witness. He's pushing this idea that when he and other Holocaust survivors are no longer here, all these others have to remember what it was and keep it alive and work hard. And he talked a lot about that. And he said things like, a dedication to memory is a dedication to truth. Well, they're not dedicated to truth. That's the sad part about it. They're not at all dedicated to truth. And again, young people are our hope. They're a little worried that these young people won't carry on. They won't carry the ball the way they need to. Your memory inherits ours. You have an ideal of saving whatever the past has to offer for the future. It's heroes and victims. That is, they need to save all this stuff. And this is what the museum does. The museum has all this stuff collected, which tells the whole story of all the horrible things that happened to the Jews. But the trouble is, it's not the truth, it's not the truth, but they want us all to think it is. And then he talked about who we're going to remember, and somebody else brought that up too. He said planning group were talking about what kind of memorial it should be, because in the beginning they only were commissioned by Carter to come up with an idea of a memorial in the United States for the Holocaust. So he said, well, we were going on and on. And he said the big question was, who are we going to remember? I think it was this Sarah Bloomfield who used these same words. Who are we going to remember? And then he was saying, trying to act like, we're not just wanting to remember Jews. We don't want to divide people. We want to bring people closer together. He said, we believe that here, what we're doing is bringing people closer together, not dividing them. But it remains that all the Jews were victims. All victims were not Jews, but all the Jews were victims. This is how they get around the fact that they wanted to be mainly about Jews. Because even though there were other victims, we don't deny that, but really, the genocide was against the Jews. All Jews were victims. Why are there so many Jews? Why were there so many Jews left afterwards? Those questions are not asked by anybody but people like us. And again, he wanted to emphasize that they're not separating people. They're not trying to separate Jews from other people. They're in the business of bringing people closer together. And then he talks about giving honor to Christians who saved lives while risking their own. And I noticed that he didn't say Christians who saved Jews, which is the only Christians that they like, they want to mention these Christians who saved Jewish lives, but he doesn't want to come right out with that. So he's saying how wonderful were all these Christians who saved lives, and that we need more people like that. We need to do that. We need to care about saving lives of whoever. I don't know. And again, it kind of emphasizes that this is the Christian duty. What Christians should be doing is looking out after others, especially Jews. That's the Christian duty. That's their message too, which a lot of Christians actually fall for if they're just totally uncritical and they're listening to these kind of things. And they're feeling, I would like to be a good Christian if they are Christian. And this is what a good, good Christian. Well, I would like to have it on my, I would like to be remembered as a Christian who tried to help these poor Jews, stuff like that. But he never, and then I'm asking right away as I'm listening, what Jews risked their lives? Why do we never talk about Jews who risked their lives saving Jews? That didn't happen. It's only Christians who are saving their lives, who are saving the lives of Jews. And So going on to Clinton, I would say that he gave a terrible, terrible speech. I haven't heard him for a long time, but it seems like he didn't put much preparation into it, and he had to come up with something. And he had that look on his face the whole time that he looked when he was saying that I never had sex with that woman when he was on television about Monica Lewinsky. I mean, he just had this look on his face. At least it seemed to me like he was not telling the truth, but he had to, you know, he had to put something over. He was doing what he was asked to do, and he was there. He'd do it as best as he could, but it didn't feel like it came from his heart or anything that he really believed. But he said all the right things and said everything that the Jews would like. And one thing that stood out to me was, he's finally trying to get around to saying something against the Nazis, but he doesn't really want to. Not that he likes them, but, you know, he doesn't want to go there particularly. But he says, no matter how smart a people are, if you have a head without a heart, you're not human. That's kind of alluding to the Germans as a smart people, but, oh, they didn't have a heart, so they weren't human. And another place he said that the Nazis gave a fever and a sickness to the Germans, and to think that all that matters, to think that all that matters is the difference between people. He was giving a little lesson on race mixing and how human beings are all alike and are, you know, 99% and a half alike and only 0.5% not alike, you know, something like that. But people put all the attention on this difference between us rather than the similarity. And this is how he distinguished this. Well, I'm going to have to finish with Clinton when I get back from the break. There's a little bit more that's interesting that he said. So I hope you stick with me, and I'll be back in 5 minutes.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätte und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätte und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour. Tonight is kind of a mixed topic, but mainly about the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, Elie Wiesel's museum, Elie Wiesel's creation, or it's a kind of a combination. It created him, he created it, and they made each other famous and influential, and so I think of them absolutely together. You know, when I was going to say, but I didn't say earlier, that when, you know, I've had this Elie Wiesel Kanza World website since mid-July or so, 2010. So it's 3 years. And, you know, I have done a lot of work on it. And I suppose you could say, you know, one of my life's purposes has become to expose everything that can be exposed about Elie Wiesel in the hopes of cutting into his great regard that he has managed to win for himself. And the Holocaust Museum, just I have about the same feelings about it because they're so much together, and I dislike both of them so much. They're both so engaged in lies and perpetuating these terrible lies. This museum is a real menace. So I was, let me get to where I was. I was finishing talking about Clinton's speech today. It was kind of funny watching him, but I didn't like it either. I could hardly stand it, truthfully. But he said that, I think he was trying to find the right tone. He didn't want to be overly emotional, which wouldn't be believable, but he wanted to say the things that would satisfy that mainly Jewish audience. And also the audience was not very spirited. I think everybody was bored. I really do. You get that feeling. I mean, even the media is bored with it and doesn't even want to run the stories much. And the audience there, during those talks, they clapped in all the right places, you know, they had the right applause, but there wasn't any great enthusiasm. There was no standing ovations or anything that I saw. And there was nothing to stand and, you know, stand about. So anyway, Clinton did his best, but I kind of think he didn't really do his best. He only did his so-so. That he said, he used the phrase, stop it from happening again. You know, that same old stuff. Sounds like Hillary told him to say that. You know, that somehow what the museum is all about is to stop it from happening again. And then he started talking about slavery. It seemed like he was much more comfortable and interested in slavery and the issues around that than he was about the Holocaust. I don't think he knows a thing about the Holocaust, truthfully. Only what, you know, generally is put out there, and he's never questioned it. He wouldn't question it. If you're a politician, you're sure not going to spend any time learning what to question about it. You're just going to ignore it and say what you're supposed to say. So that's what he does. But he knows more about slavery. So he said, but he's, he said something, I think, that he misinterpreted. And he said, he mentioned Thomas Jefferson and a few other people from our early days, also Washington, but only this one I wrote down. He said that Jefferson remarked, and at some point, famous remark of his, that when he thought about slavery, he trembled to know that God was just. And he said that like in the fact of, you know, that slavery was so unjust and the Holocaust was so unjust and blah, blah. But when you think about it, I hadn't thought about it before, but when I think about Jefferson saying this, what he means is when he thought about slavery, he trembled to know that God was just. That is not that God was, you know, instituted slavery, but that some people are inferior to other people. And God created everyone, and God is just. So that is the way God did it, you know, and we shouldn't be denying it or saying it's not so or it shouldn't be so. Because God being just, God created humanity the way he did. I don't have this particular belief, but that's what, you know, that was the Christian belief then. And he created people unequal, because there wouldn't be slavery if there wasn't, you know, that's what it means to me. I don't know if anybody has a different idea. You can call in this hour at 1-830-443-4911 and express yourself on that. I think Clinton misinterpreted this, though, for the use here and that he used it on this occasion. And he called the Holocaust Memorial Museum our conscience. You know, I don't know. He was saying some other things and he ended up by saying, this is, you know, he was saying this is this and this is that, but the Holocaust Memorial is our conscience. Then he gave I already talked that. He mentioned, that Einstein, when he was talking about the differences in humans being so minuscule, that we shouldn't even pay attention to it. He mentioned that Einstein has had the biggest brain anyone ever had. Ha! Huh? Yeah. You know, what cornball things to say. That made the crowd happy. And, well, that's it. I already said the others. So, you know, he basically was just there catering to the Jews, saying what he needed to say to them. And they applauded, but not with any great enthusiasm. So it was all very uninspired. I don't think Weasel wasn't inspired either. He seemed to be bored with himself also. I think it's a sign of the fatigue of this big lie. But there are people that are going to keep pushing it because they've got all their, in the background, they're putting out all their propaganda, which I'm going to, what have I got here? What is that? Okay, I'm going to talk about now a little bit more about their plans and what they're doing. I've got it in my article. One thing is that, you know, that I haven't mentioned, I may have kind of in passing, but you have this this whole thing started, you know, with I get these things. You know, there was the President's Commission on the Holocaust that was headed by Elie Wiesel. And they spent about a year and a half and they wrote up this long report that they presented to President Carter on September 27th, 1979. And then he went ahead and, I guess put it before Congress too. Congress, authorized that there would be a council, a Holocaust. I don't know what that's called now. I've even written about it, but I don't have it. I've got it somewhere. But it was you know, the Holocaust Memorial Council, and that was headed. Carter was on that too. It was headed by him, but then it's not headed by him now because it still exists. And it is, it has always existed, and it is the power behind the museum. You know, that's the authority that the museum has from this Holocaust Memorial Council. So but I think the names, this 34 names that I looked at was from that original, Holocaust, President's Commission on the Holocaust. And there are 34 people on that commission that I suppose they kind of picked themselves and then recommended themselves to Carter. But all of them are Jews. I saw the list of them and even their signatures. And again, Weasel's signature is nothing like that signature of that Lazar Weasel that signed that one U.S. government form that they claim shows that he was at Buchenwald. Well, it's nothing at all like that signature. But again, you can't get anybody to pay attention to that, except, you know, people like us. But just think that they'd have this commission. And every member, 34 of them, were all, every one of them was a Jew. So what kind of a deal is this? You know, this is just a Jewy deal. It's just a Jew thing. And there was the one that surprised me on there, that I think only one that's not a Jew, and that was Telford Taylor. You know, Telford Taylor became famous at the Nuremberg trials as a prosecutor, and he was... he was with the British team, and then he I think he ended up in living in the United States. I don't know why that is, but anyway, I might have something wrong, you know, something missing there. But he died. He lived until he was 90, and I thought, well, he was a friend of the Jews. They put him on there. But I thought, well, I wonder if he's a Jew, too. Well, I looked them all up and found out that his second wife is Jewish. His second wife, who he had been married to at that time, I had a clue because it said he had two sons by her. He had a couple of children with his first wife, who had a very non-Jewish name. And then the second wife, he had two more children, and they were named Benjamin and Samuel. So I looked her up, and there I found, yep, she works with Yeshiva University, and she's on some kind of Jewish stuff, and some of it's not, some of it isn't, and some of it is. So Toby Golick, his second wife, is Jewish. So so there's that. Then the kind of work that they're doing at the Holocaust Museum, as I said, trying to raise a whole lot more money in order to act like they don't need this money from the federal government every year. They say they have this special need for it, you know, special stuff for their anniversary. And, they gave some plans of what they're going to do. Part of it is to fight anti-Semitism. They're engaged also in the battle worldwide of fighting anti-Semitism. but as it is, they in this financial report, they give some of their activities. And here's what they use this money for. Here's what they brag about they did in 2011. They continued to expand the victims' names list. They're creating this name list of all the victims of the Holocaust. They don't know who these names are. They, you know, Yad Vashem has a bunch of names. There's no investigating about them. They just, anybody says, sends in a name to them, they just add it to their list. Anyway, this USHMM is working on this victims' names list, and they're sharing their information with Yad Vashem. Now, Yad Vashem is Israeli. You know, it's the Israeli, it's an Israeli government institution. And our museum is a United States government institution, too. So, and they're working together. Not only that, there was something more that they're doing, that we're doing with Israel. But one thing I didn't mention that's interesting, I do have it in this article. Where is it? Oh, yeah, that at the original dedication ceremonies for this museum on April 22nd, 1993, the speeches were by, at that time, Bill Clinton had just become president, so he was invited, and he gave a speech. That's why they had him give a speech this time, because he gave it on the original opening of the museum. And Harvey Meyerhoff, who is chairman of the Memorial Council, that council, once the building went up, it was Harvey Meyerhoff, not Elie Wiesel, and his name is on there. But also, keep losing my place, but along with Harvey, Elie Wiesel, so Bill Clinton, Elie Wiesel, Harvey Meyerhoff, and who was the other person who spoke? Chaim Herzog, president of Israel. They brought over the president of Israel to speak at the opening of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. I found that utterly terrible, just terrible. I can imagine what his speech was like. Oh, we are so happy to see what you have achieved here in America, where we have so many of our own people living and contributing, blah, blah, blah. Well, the names list, and they're sharing it with the Yad Vashem. And so this makes it clearly a Jewish project, you know. These are all Jewish names that they're looking for, that they're getting, I imagine, for the most part. And it also shows that they're not fact-based. You can't get a list of victims' names and expect it to be reliable and be representing the truth. So that's another thing about this museum, is that it is not like a good museum should be. It doesn't care about the truth. It only cares about, it's a propaganda outfit. So another thing they did was in 2011, they distributed 6,500 Days of Remembrance DVD planning guides. How important is this? You know, the main thing that they were asked to do as being the representative for the Holocaust in the United States is to organize the Days of Remembrance. That the Congress accepted that way back when. And the Days of Remembrance is, again, it's from Israel. It's their Yom HaShoah Day to remember the Holocaust and their Holocaust Memorial Day. And we took that on here in the United States. And the USHMM was supposed to be in charge of that to see that there was, you know, that there was some encouragement about doing this, but that's only a few days each year. It's not such a big deal. But they take that seriously, so they have distributed, they put out these planning guides for the Day of Remembrance, and this time they sent it to 67 military installations abroad, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Germany, and South Korea. Now, why do these military installations need this, and why do they need to celebrate this Holocaust remembrance every year? Is that, you know, is that stupid or what? What is that? That's just pure propaganda to these military people who might be prepared to believe anything. And is this worth doing? Should money be spent on all this? Well, if the Jews want to spend their money doing this, but the taxpayers of the United States should not have their money spent to do this. And these packets are quite elaborate. In fact, I've got a link to a lot of these things. You can go and look at them. They're how-to packets featuring historical background, what they call historical background material, which is all lies, poster sets, videos, readings, personal histories, you know, those personal histories, but these are more lies. And then the Holocaust victim name list, they even send that to them. What are they going to do with that? I guess maybe add some names. This is, again, this is just Jewish propaganda being put out by this museum. They also say they served over 3,000 members of the judiciary in 9 states, giving them continuing legal education credits in ethics. They are sponsoring this damn museum with all their ignoramus people running it, they're sponsoring continuing legal education credits in ethics. And they're having members of the judiciary get a credit for taking this. I don't know. I guess the government okays it. It can't get any more obvious, you know, that what's going on here. And it's like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. You know, they do the same things. Because they also brag in their report that over 2,000 law enforcement officials completed training, including 150 chiefs and top leaders. So now they're also training law enforcement officials, and including the police chiefs and so on, with their legal education in ethics. They're training them in ethics. You know, what kind of ethics are they getting from these people? Now, what else they did, they implemented in 2011 with their money, they implemented a propaganda initiative aimed at journalists and diplomatic programs. Aiming at journalists, okay, and diplomats that were such as different things, a special exhibition website titled State of Deception, the Power of Nazi Propaganda. They're teaching people to recognize deceptive propaganda, and an online course developed in conjunction with the Poynter Institute. Well, the Poynter Institute is some kind of a flaky news college for journalists or something. We're very flaky looking. DVD on propaganda distributed nationally to educators. So they're sending out DVDs about propaganda to educators nationally at all levels. And then the last thing, they send out the Fred Friendly program titled The Context and Consequences of Propaganda, distributed by the leading distributor of college, university, and secondary school resources in the United States. So all they do is put out propaganda from their point of view, you know, from the Jewish point of view. So it's exactly as we have been saying, and as Tan has been saying for a long time, they're just about what's good for the Jews, and they're putting this, they do it by making the rest of us feel that we are responsible for protecting Jewish interests and Jewish opportunities and so on, no matter what. You know, that's our job to be good white people and good Christian people and so on, is to make sure that we look after the Jews, so and never again can it happen to them what happened to them before. So we have to feel responsible for what happens to them. No way do we have to feel responsible. No way is this. We need to, you know, people need to be responding to this kind of thing. Revisionists need to be responding to this kind of thing. Not just going over and over why the Holocaust didn't happen, because anybody who wants to know that can know it. Well, of course, something happened. There's a lot that happened, but it wasn't a Holocaust. But it's the same as with the knowing that people know 9/11 did not happen according to what they say, but doesn't change anything. So we have to go after the perpetrators of all this. We have to go after the bottom line that keeps their story in place, which is that somehow they suffered and it's our fault. You know, that they suffered so much, it's our fault, and it's the worst thing that ever happened in the history of the world, and we can never let it happen again, things like that, which, unfortunately, people are falling for. They are falling for it. Let's see. What else? I have a few other things here, but I have to find them. I would like to comment on, got a few stories here. I would like to comment on, this German actor, television actor, Horst Tappert. He was very popular on German television. He was played the role of a chief inspector, Stephen Derrick, in this detective series that they had actually running for years from, I have it here, from 1974 to 1998. It ran in more than 100 countries. He's a very beloved person. As a matter of fact, I heard from Willy Wenger today, and he commented that he was so angry that they have dredged up Horst Tappert's being in the Waffen-SS and make a big thing out of it, because obviously he liked this program too. And he was talking about how terrible, you know, just how angry it makes him that they do this. Now, what they say in this article about it, it was the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, a newspaper, a reporter or an investigation they did or something that reported all this. So they can't leave these people alone. You know, they found out that he had, in 1943 at least, he had joined a tank unit of the Waffen-SS on the Eastern Front. Now, why not? You know, I figured out he was born in 1923, so he was only 20 years old in 1943. So he's a young 20-year-old German. It said before that, he was, they had all these young Germans doing, he was an anti-aircraft you know, he was working on an anti-aircraft site where they're, you know, where they're manning these guns for when planes come over. And all the young people were doing it. Well, then he transferred to a Waffen-SS elite corps, they say, which one he was in. Let's see. I don't see that. They should have put it in here. They have all this information. But this was known, I guess, for a while after the war. Then it all went quiet, and nobody was commenting on it. They were not trying to get the man in trouble, and it was pretty much forgotten about. Well, then you have all these people that hunting for some Nazis. And they say association with Hitler's SS has come back to haunt other high-profile Germans. He started as reservist in an anti-aircraft battery before joining the tank regiment. So he was a patriotic German. So what? It's nothing. But of course he's dead now, so they can't really hurt him. But they're trying to hurt his memory. And he's a kind of a sweet looking old guy in his picture. But his pictures, there's a lot of this pictures of him where he looks a lot older than in this picture that they had in this article. But that's one thing. And then another is, and now I have to look all over the place for things. Okay. There's this article, about this United States Holocaust Museum opening. I was looking around to see if I could find some other stories, and I looked at Salon, you know, that Salon.com, which is so left-ish, so like Huffington Post, and, you know, and they did have a story on it, and they had a part of it that was not in any of the others. It was the same newspaper writing. It was the same article that I had seen on other sites, you know, like on Yahoo and so on, and NBC and so on. But they had a section of it which the others didn't have. So I guess they cut it out. I guess these other places cut this section out. But it was written, obviously, by the USHMM in their press release. And what it says is, Non-Jews were also punished for violating German policies against mixing of ethnic groups. See, they were talking about how terrible all the things that were going on then, you know, for punishing people who weren't German and so on. But they say that not punishing the Jews, but they say that non-Jews were also punished. And they say, for the first time, the museum is showing striking rare footage of a ritualistic shaming of a Polish girl and a German boy being punished for having a relationship. Now, this really gets me because listen to some of the details of this. They don't know where it was filmed, really, but and they don't, and there's no date on it, but they want you to believe it. Now, I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I mean, it's just one of these things. They are marched through the streets of a town in present-day Poland, where the film was located more recently in an attic. That is, whenever this happened, I don't know. They don't tell you when it happened. But the film was located in an attic, you know, hidden in an attic. How many times have we seen that? I've seen a lot of fake stuff that I've looked at in the past. And the story was, it just came out, you know, they just come out with this thing, oh, something just discovered, and it was discovered in somebody's attic. Well, it's possible to discover things in attics, people's attics, but it's a little, you know, you have to be questioned a little bit, because there's never any details about it. And they say dozens of people in this film, dozens of people are looking on as Nazi officers, I'm not sure how they know they're Nazi officers, cut the hair of two teenagers. They are forced to look at their nearly bald heads, nearly bald, I bet, in a mirror before their hair is burned, the hair that they cut off and they burned it. It's not hard to focus on the cruelty that's being perpetrated on this young couple. This is this Bachrock, who is the curator of the special exhibit for the anniversary, the one that is entitled Some Were Neighbors. Collaboration and complicity in the Holocaust. So this is part of what she was saying that was taken out of the other one. She says, you know, this is such cruelty. They cut the hair of these kids. Such cruelty that's being perpetrated on this young couple. But what we really want people to look at is all the other people who are standing around watching this. You know, all these guilty people who are watching and not rushing in to stop it or do something about it. Now, I don't know. That's all they tell you. Now, what, you know, the Holocaust Museum, somebody sends this to them. And this is how irresponsible they are there. Anything they get that they can make Germans look bad, or even non-Germans look bad. Now, it's Poles here. This is in a Polish town, but it's supposedly the Germans who are doing it. Because they didn't want, they probably had supposedly there was a law against mixing between the Poles and the Germans. Now, what is a German boy being doing living in a Polish town unless he always lived there, unless he's one of these, you know, Germans in Poland? I don't know. They don't explain any of this. They don't know anything. They're just filling in the empty spaces is what I think. In order to have one more exhibit that makes Nazis look bad, or, you know, that makes it look like people were so cruel, you know, these cruel laws that don't want people to mix themselves. And, you know, it's just this stuff. Now, then she goes on to say in here that they bring up the Holocaust by bullets. Say, other items displayed in this, in her show, in her exhibit, include dozens of bullets excavated from the site of a mass grave in former Soviet territory and registration cards from city offices in Western and Southern Europe labeling people with a J for Jew. Now, what's wrong with putting a J on a person's registration card for Jew? You know, I mean, they make a crime out of every damn thing they can find. They make it, oh, isn't this sinister? Because in these Western and Southern Europe offices, whatever that means, they put a J on the registration cards. I think, you know, we know, and we talk about this in the International Jew, that the Jews are known to deny that they're Jews, that try to pass as something else or as nothing. They still do it. And they wanted to make sure that everybody knew who was a Jew, because the Jews won't be honest about it. So, and they think it shouldn't matter. It's okay. You know, they think they should live among people as Jews, loyal to their Jewish tribe, but not have to proclaim that they're Jews, not have anywhere said that they're Jews. I was looking at another thing on one of these exhibits. Propaganda programs that the museum sends out, that was saying how there was a law that finally passed. I guess it was in Germany, I guess. I have to go back and look at it, but required Jews to use Jewish names. Because that's another thing they do. And I 100% agree with that. The National Socialists passed this thing that Jews had to have Jewish names. They couldn't go by German names and, you know, try to hide with non-Jewish names. And if they had a non-Jewish name that, you know, I mean, they'd had it for a while. It was their real name. They had to add Israel or Sarah as a middle name, whether they were, you know, I shouldn't laugh, I guess, but whether they were male or female. But they should have Jewish names. They made a point of taking non-Jewish names so that they could hide and not be detected as Jewish and get away with a lot of things, a lot of Jewish tricks and so on, and not have to be really identified. And they do that in the United States. They've always done that. So these are things that they do that are wrong. They try to pretend like there's nothing wrong with that, but there is something wrong with it because of their behavior. So I think I'm gonna do something else for a. Let me get back to here. I had thought that I would comment on a thread on VNN forum just for the fun of it. So I think I'll do that now. And if anybody wants to comment on anything about the Holocaust Museum or anything I've said, you're free to call in and make the comment. I should say. Yeah, I have one more thing here. The story that I just found on Yahoo News before I came on the air, and this is about today. Survivors and their U.S. liberators meet together in Washington. And there's this funny, funny picture of Elie Wiesel and this World War II vet and Bill Clinton and a young Negro woman standing close to Elie Wiesel and holding on to his suit sleeve, holding on to his arm. And she looks, I just can't figure out who she is. It says her name is Rebecca Dupas. In the whole story, she's never mentioned. So I don't know who she belongs to or what she's doing there, but obviously she's related to somebody. And there's Elie, not looking at her. And there's this old World War II vet, 90 years old, named Uten. Oops. Okay. Named Scotty Uten. He looks like a real go-getter. He's got quite a few medals on. And then there's Bill Clinton looking out at the cameras. This smile, with his politician smile, you know, his red face and all. What a crowd. These pictures just show there's something so weird about all this stuff. It's so fake. It's so phony. And I'm not going to say anything more about the story. But it does say that, let's see, I just saw here that... I thought I saw something about this Uten being having liberated the camp, but I don't see it. So I'm going to go on. So I'm going to go over to, to VNN Forum. And I just, somebody alerted me to a thread that took place on January 25th. And it's just got 2.5 pages to it or so. But it's, and I was quite interested in it because it was about the radio program I had back around that time where Will Williams was on with Bill Fink. And it turned out kind of not to be such a very good program in that Will and Bill didn't get along at all, and I was trying to kind of moderate, and things were getting, you know, were too unfriendly. And I knew that Will had started it, so people here think that I was picking on Will. But then Hadding Scott came into the program in the second hour, maybe. I don't know how long he was there, but so it, and then we had a caller, a couple callers, so it got to be kind of a messy at times. But I thought, you know, when that program came about, they make it out here like I was setting something up. And I just wanted to answer that. I'm not on VNN. I'm not going to register and write comments, but I'm going to comment on it right here in this program since I have plenty of time to do it. What happened there was that I had been wanting for some time to do, thinking it would be a good idea back then. I don't think it's a good idea anymore at all. But I did then, to have a program between white nationalists who are on different sides about Christianity and religion. You know, I knew quite a few who were, you know, liked the idea of, I don't know, either paganism or some kind of the William Pierce religion or some kind of Odinism or something, or some nature religion, but and those who follow Christianity, because I knew that there are a lot of good people, a lot of good Christians, and a lot of good Christian identists who are very, very race loyal, much more than a lot of others. So this is one of the big problems in white nationalism, and right now it's getting a big head of steam again amongst a lot of these young bloggers. They might not like me calling them that, but over there at Total Fascism, and then the Renegade Broadcasting guys, and all of this is, and you know, when you read these comments on their comment sections about it, that people are just all over the place and believing all kinds of different things, and there's no togetherness. You know, you can't ever get together with this. And I found out from that program that you can't bring these people together and think that you're gonna, that there's gonna be any kind of resolution. There's not. When it comes to religion, there's never gonna be a resolution between this side and that side, and people just have to accept one another. But I found that the anti-Christians are the ones who cannot accept Christians, and especially Christian identity. But the Christian people are much more tolerant of the ones who aren't Christians, but they don't want them to be so anti-Christian. Well, this is what happened here. So the first Rounder, or Glenn Miller, who I like, who started this thread. And who here has ever heard of William Fink? Not me. I listened to the entire show. Perhaps some of you did too. Of course, I agree with Will on Christianity, but I gotta admit, this Fink is one slick talking fellow, in spite of being Christian identity. Let's find out more about him. And then he posted what I had posted on the program. So that was a nice start. But there's this Cora McGuire there who says nice things about me, so I like her. And she just said, you know, she thought it was a good show, but she thought it was kind of interesting. And she explained that Carolyn is good friends with William Fink, has had him on many times. She didn't say anything negative about anybody. She thinks more along the lines of Will, I think, but she's open-minded and, about people. And then, Glenn Miller comes back and he said some nice things about me. I like him too. He seems to basically like me, which unlike a lot of the people on this VNN forum. But then he said it was obvious during the show that she and Fink teamed up to drown Will out, constantly interrupting him, and it seems that the volume was turned down when Will spoke. Well, I thought that was kind of amazing, and I just want to tell Glenn and anybody else that's listening who says things like this that I don't have anything to do with the volume of people's voices. You know, I couldn't control it if I wanted to, which I don't. And some people, their equipment is different, they talk softer. Which Will is kind of a southern speaker. He's not loud. Bill Fink has a very penetrating voice. And I do too, somewhat. You know, I can really get loud and sound loud, but I have a kind of a strong voice, I guess, even though it gets a little wavery. But Will is different. So if Will came off quieter, that was his... I know he was on Skype, but still, that's just that. It's not, you know, there certainly was no teaming up and there was no effect, you know, affecting the volume. And I never do anything like that. And I find it kind of amazing that people will throw things like that out when they don't have any idea. They don't suggest it, but they say it's obvious that it was like that. And then Alex Linder says about Bill Fink, he's some kind of CI, listening to the show, I'm surprised Will doesn't know better than to be drawn into that kind of garbage. And Alex Linder is very down on the whole thing and just totally down on CI. Well, it's understandable. I wouldn't expect anything different from Alex Linder. But, I'm not saying that in a nasty way. I mean, that's Alex's point of view on all things religious and particularly Christian. So, and then he says some other things, like that. And he says, Alex says, it reinforces the need for disciplined politics. People must hew to an ideological line on the most important stuff. People must ostracize those who fall afoul of behavioral standards. People don't want to do either of these things because it imposes discipline on them and interferes with their entertainment. Well, that's a nice, wise talk, but it doesn't say anything about anybody in particular, you know. So who are these people? And you know, it's a different, people have different opinions about who's falling afoul of behavioral standards, right? So you can't just say people must do this, people must do that. He doesn't want, you know, Alex Linder doesn't want anything totalitarian. He doesn't want anybody putting down any big laws on him, but yet he makes these statements about how people need to act. Based on nothing but wishful thinking, basically. And then Jimmy Marr comes on and says stupid things. That even without Fink on the show, I shut Will down the last time he was on. He was on with Hattie, and he wanted to read something from William Pierce on Christianity. So I said, all right. And he starts reading. Well, you know, several minutes later, he's still reading, and I'm wondering where the end of this is. So I break in, and I say, I think that's enough of that. You know, 2 or 3 minutes is a long time on the radio when you're reading something. And it was very, you know, there's no point to it. There was no point in it. It's just his own very, very strong anti-Christianity. But he wanted to finish it. Well, let me just finish. I said, I don't think so. I said, I think you got the idea. You know, we can tell people to go there and read it for themselves. It just made me very uncomfortable because it was very anti-Christian in a way that I don't like. And so he says from that, I got criticism for that from people who think like that. And Mars says, Carolyn has been openly carrying Fink's water for a good while now. What a way to put things. You know, I have not been doing that at all. And he says, we're the Joseph and Mary of Christ-tard nationalism. Carolyn claims not to be a Christ-tard, but a blind man can see that she pushes that crap and shields it from criticism. Well, I shield it from criticism, I do. I don't like his kind of talking, Christ-tard and things like that. I know too many nice people and intelligent people and better people than him who follow this. And so I don't allow this kind of anti-talk and ugly talk, using ugly, insulting words on my programs. And then he says, he wonders why Tanstaffel is hanging out over there. Not knowing that Tanstaffel built the whole thing. Oh, he starts saying some things about Tan that he likes. He likes Tan. Part of that is they don't like women so much over there on VNN. But then Alex Linder says she is a CT on SH, which I will not discuss, speaking about me. And turned out that that meant Christ hard on, no, didn't mean that. It turned out that he meant by that conspiracy theorist on Sandy Hook, which was not, he was not insulting me or anything. He was just stating the fact that as he sees it, because we've discussed that off the air, not on the program, a little bit on the program, we've discussed that. And he's not, he doesn't go into any of the conspiracies. I don't think even 9/11. And I can't figure out these people. And Hadding is the same way. But so he thinks I'm a conspiracy theorist on Sandy Hook. He calls it Shady Hook. But he says he will not discuss. But anyway, Alex and I get along just fine. Yeah. Then Glenn Miller comes back and says, because he's upset about. I guess Will not beating up Bill Fink better. So he's saying, after interrupting Will to the max, as well as lowering the volume when he spoke, and then shutting down talk about Christianity and changing the subject, Carolyn and Fink effectively prevented Will from making his full case. Well, if Will had to make his full case by reading from William Pierce, a long, long anti-Christian thing, that's not making a case. You make a case by speaking, your own words to make a case. And Bill Fink wasn't reading anything like that. So I thought that Will, I did think that Will, right off the bat, was insulting to Bill Fink. And I was all trying to be equal because I like Will Williams very much. In spite of his anti-Christianity, that doesn't bother me. I like him a lot, and he's a very likable guy. So I thought it might be, a nice program with two people who didn't know each other meeting and all that. Well, it didn't turn out that way because right off the bat, Will wanted to just kind of put down Bill Fink and his beliefs. He did it right away without any good reason. And so that bothered me, and I spoke up about it and said, now, let's not talk like that, things like that. And that, I guess, was supposed to be interfering with him. And but then Glenn Miller says, I browsed Fink's website. It seems to be a genuine anti-Jew, pro-white, and pro-NS website with lots of good articles and videos. Not much about CI, though. Well, I don't know if he was on the right website. He might have been on the Mein Kampf website rather than on his main website because there's lots of CI there, but maybe he didn't notice it. Anyway, he says... Glenn Miller says perhaps he pretends to be a Christian because he believes it'll gain him far more supporters, financial and otherwise. I'd like to have Glenn Miller on my program as a guest. I thought I would just ask him right here today if anybody's listening to this to pass this on, because I don't know his email, but I could certainly get it from Alex, because I think I like him. I like listening to him. He just really says what he thinks. And I think it would be fun to have him on. So I do invite him on. He says, that Bill might be pretending to be a Christian. That's funny. Or Either that or he's a clever saboteur with lots of time, energy, and money to throw into his schemes. Well, that's not anywhere close to the truth. But he says that he thinks Bill Fink has an intelligence, a polished voice, and Jew wiseness, which he approves of. So he can't fit that together with Christian identity. Well, then Cora McGuire says some truthful things, trying to bring in some facts, and I appreciate that. Jimmy Marr, well, I was responding to Rounder. And let's see, there's not too much more that's of importance here, but I thought there was one more thing. That's only page one. Maybe from Glenn Miller. Okay. Well, somebody called towards Wuhlsberg, who would be, you know, a pro-paganish type thinker, said Will was blindsided by these two dilettantes. Well, he wasn't blindsided. He knew exactly what he was getting into. It wasn't like that at all. Both of whom are obsessed with an irrelevant Jew book that is around, okay. He says, I attempted to comment on Jaeger's site and never saw it get past moderation. Well, I can imagine what it was. Oh, I guess only 60 seconds. I'm all over the show already. Well, then there's a nice guy named Thomas 777 who comes on and actually says some intelligent things in defense of Christianity. And Hadding came on, and he was saying some things one thing I wanted to comment that Hadding said, which he says a lot, is that Christianity is not effective in opposing Jews. This is one of Hadding's real beliefs. Christianity is not effective in opposing Jews. And we've actually had some words about that between us. But I thought I would clear up there that this whole idea that I lower people's voices, that I take sides, and that, you know, when two people are on, and that I was doing that during that show. So not anything too important, but I'm glad I got to say it. And I thank you all for listening to tonight's rather strange program, and I hope you will return again. Good night for the Heretics Hour.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynjaeger.com.